Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode of Set Lusting Bruce, your podcast all about Bruce Springsteen, his music, and mostly his fans. I am doing something a little unusual. We are recording on Saturday morning, and normally that means my guest is in the UK or in another country, but Adrian wanted to join me because she's an early riser, so she's in the great state of Florida. I'm in the great state of Texas. You did not get us here to debate the merits of our individual governors. But Adrian Trier-Beenick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, and excellent job on my names.
Yes. So you guys missed that we spent a little bit talking about it. No one missays Jesse, but consistently it's misspelled. It's J-S-I-E, J-S-Y, so I am used to that. But normally people don't mispronounce Jesse, so I get it, huh?
Yeah, and I get Andrea a lot. But my best one was I said my name at Starbucks so they could write your name on the coffee cup.
Yeah.
And they wrote Andrew. Like, they just gave up.
Yeah, said, just Andrew. Yeah.
We're just going to call you Andrew. And I was like, I'm an honorary man today. That's great. Sure.
Okay, that's the thing wrong with that. Yeah. So, Adrian, tell us about yourself.
Sure. I'm Adrian Trier-Beenick. I am a sociology professor. I have a PhD in sociology, and I am in Orlando. My area of focus is gender and media, or gender and pop culture. So I've been studying the impact pop culture has on society, specifically through the lens of gender, for about 20 years. I've published quite a bit in the area. I've done quite a few books. I just signed a deal for a book on Taylor Swift. So that's my next sort of focus. I've done one on Beyonce. I've done stuff on pop culture. I've done things on feminist theory. I think the thing we're going to talk about today is my book on Tori Amos, which was my doctoral dissertation research, where I looked at how women specifically have used her music to heal after they've experienced trauma. I have a podcast. It's called Most Popular, where I look at the way that pop culture influences society. And I bring on guests who are experts in different fields to talk about the relationship between gender and pop culture through all sorts of different avenues. I had a really great economist on a couple months ago where we talked about the economic impact of the Barbie movie and the Taylor Swift tour and Beyonce's tour. Just folks from all across the spectrum, because pop culture influences everything we do, I live in Orlando. I like riding my bike. I don't like mushrooms. I'm a Scorpio.
Sounds great. A lot to unpack there, and we're going to get to it all, hopefully. I've shared this to multiple times on the podcast, that at the end of 2021, I was reading something, or something talked to me about diversity. And I realized, if I wasn't careful, that doing a Bruce Springsteen-themed podcast, I could have a bunch of, and this in the kindest way, old white guys, because I'm an old white guy, talking about Bruce's music, right? And I thought it was important to try to get different voices. and different perspectives. And I've done that a lot. I've been able to get much more female voices. I've been blessed to have a lot of Springsteen fans that are in their early 20s, you know, that share that they are new to the Springsteen fandom. Have had a little bit of success in getting people that are of either Hispanic or African American. The only thing I haven't done very well is getting more people from the more conservative end of the political spectrum. And that is not because I have not opened my heart. I'm like, hey, if you love Ted Nugent, all Malrapport to you. If you want to come and talk about why Ted music means the world to you, come on and in, and we will stay away from politics. So I guess I'm going to start with why do you think, and we're going to get to something fun in a minute, but I want to get to we'll get cut to the chase. Why do you think at times there is such an anger or there's an argument about gender? About this, we want to treat people the same, but often people don't understand that when you say you're treating people the same, understand that certain people in certain situations already have a lead in the race, right? Mm-hmm. If it's a 2 mile race, they're starting at mile one and going. So let's solve this, Adrian, in just a few minutes. Go.
Sure, no problem. No problem. World, we like to say that on a lot of worlds, we like to say that gender is what's called a social construction. So as a society, we've decided what gender is. And it's important that we're not talking about sex, right? Because sex is what you were born and the doctor said, boy, girl, whatever. Gender is your identity, right? So gender is something that is so baked into our society that people feel some sort of ownership over what they think gender should be. And it's interesting that we're talking about music as the purpose of this podcast. And it's interesting because culture is like one of the biggest ways that we decide what we think gender should be. Like when I was growing up in the 80s, and I'm from a really small town in northern Michigan, and people would see on TV when MTV just came out, the two houses in my town that had MTV, but people would see people with blue hair or boys wearing skirts or women in something that looked more masculine. And that just seemed to be so controversial, right? Because that stuff was the generation that was raising those children were taught that never, ever do you cross that line. And we're seeing more equitable treatment. I'm not going to say it's great, but I'm going to say we're seeing more equitable treatment of people and their gender identity. And that brings up those feelings because the second that change starts to happen in a culture, people's natural reaction is to push back against it. The hardest thing you can do is change a culture. It is so difficult because it is so set in our minds that this is what's happening. However, I teach college students, so I see the 18 to 22 year old crowd daily. And I have noticed in the last 5 or 6 years that they are much more in tune with what gender identity is. I don't have to explain terms like I used to. They know what things are. I think a lot of this is because of social media and things have become real common on there. But when you have something that is just, it's become a norm in a society and someone challenges that, the reaction is to push back against it. And that's what's happening, I think, with gender. And the other side of it is, especially if you think about the LGBTQ plus community, it's very easy to pick on groups of people that are being oppressed. It's very easy to pick a group of people that are already suffering and just push a little harder because it's safe. It's a safe way to oppress somebody. And that in and of itself makes conversations about gender feel like they're more bubbly to the surface, because those groups of people are being picked on a little bit more, right? It's the culture wars. It's the way to engage people with stuff that on the surface, people may say, oh, that's not that big of a deal. Who cares if we make fun of people who wear dresses or whatever? But the underlying thing of that is much more insidious and I think much more damaging.
So I promise listeners we're going to get to music and something, but I did want to tell one story and then have you comment on it if you don't mind. My brother passed last year. He cannot defend himself, but I'm told sorry. Him this to his face. So that's okay. No. Brother was someone who was very opinionated about everything. right? It wasn't, I don't care for the new Star Trek. No, J.J. Abrams' Star Trek has ruined the franchise and it is an abomination, right? He's that kind of guy. And so he was incredibly offended by not doing he, she, like they, this gender neutral pronouns really bothered him. That how dare they make me call them what we want, they want them to call me, right? And so I said, okay, you were born Grover Dean Jackson. From the moment you had awareness, you asked us to call you Dean because you didn't want to be called Grover because it sounds like Rover and you're a dog. Now we can discuss the reason my mom did this is that my great-grandmother's husband was Grover O'Banion. She asked when my mom was having, could you name him after your grandfather? So she did. So Dean, how is this different? How is you choosing the name you want to use different than someone asking about a pronoun? It just is. And then we move on. So any quick thoughts about that? And then we'll get to something more fun. Women using music to help heal from abuse. We're going to get to a more fun subject.
See where he would push back on that. Because yeah. It's like I said, it's so hard to convince people that yeah. There is some logic to this.
Yeah.
But I think the way you handled it was great. That there's no, your identity is your identity. And you yeah. go by what you want people to see.
Yeah.
And that should be up to the person to decide. If I want to write something under a different name and still get the credit for it, that's just my identity. Just
yeah.
a different type of person or a different type of me, but still the same person. But I can see why he would push back on that because like I said, it's really just, it's woven into our mindsets.
And I think that it is, I think we're getting better at it, but as a whole, as I generalize, no one likes being called in on their shit, right? And it's embarrassing when you go, oh, and I have been lucky enough, at least over for a while, that I just go, oh, wow, you're right. I don't know if I can change overnight, but I'm going to do my best because you've just shown me how to do that. So, yeah, you talked a little bit already, but share again, where did you grow up and what kind of music was your family listening to?
So I grew up in a really small town in northern Michigan, on Lake Michigan. And my parents were, my dad was born in 49 and my mom was born in 51. So they were prime like 60s, 70s rock yeah. people. So The Doors, Led Zeppelin, Fleetwood Mac, Edwin Starr, Janis Joplin, like that, Aretha Franklin. That was, my mother loved Aretha Franklin. That was my most everything. And there was never not music playing in my parents' house. They had the radio on constantly, but you have to keep in mind that the radio in my town was one radio station that sometimes worked. And eventually when I was in high school, we got two radio stations, but it was one radio station and it was whatever was still popular with the folks running it. So it was a lot of like Beach Boys and 50s doo-wop and that kind of thing, which has its place. I'm not saying here nor there, but it wasn't very diverse and it wasn't very eclectic. When I was in high school, eventually one very brave person set up a record store in the neighboring town, not my town. It was about a 30 minute drive from where my parents are. My parents live in the middle of nowhere in the country. It's wooded. They don't have Wi-Fi availability out there. It's barely cell service. You can imagine in 1997, when a record store goes in 30 minutes away, people just flocked to it.
Sure.
And yeah, they were very like, you're not going to listen to the kind of mainstream pop. You're going to hear this rock from when we were growing up. There's a lot of stuff that I know the songs and the lyrics, but I don't know who sang it because it wasn't streamed. I wasn't always paying attention to what records they were pulling out, but I can recognize a lot of the songs.
I find there's, in general, two types of people that join me. The people that really embrace their parents' music, and then as they started growing musically, expanded their base. and to others that rejected their parents' music. And then when they turned 30, went, oh, that guy, Johnny Cash, my dad liked a lot. He's pretty good. Are you either or?
I don't know that I embraced it or rejected it. I appreciated it, I think maybe is the better term. I understand very deeply why, like, my dad was drafted into Vietnam. So I understand very deeply why the music of that time was so important, because that's what got him through the almost 2 years that it took for Soup to Nuts for him. So I get that part quite a bit. I don't know that I rejected it. I think I have a really good basis for what music sounds like now and versus what it did sound like. And before audio tuning came in and having to make things digitally and before iTunes was iTunes, I think that's what it gave me more than whether or not I liked it or not.
Can you remember, is there a band or a musician that kind of was the first one that felt like it was yours? You're laughing.
Paula Abdul.
Okay. Nothing wrong with that.
No. She is the queen and always will be in my mind. Oh yeah. Paula Abdul. The Teen Beat magazine craze of the 80s. And I had it all on my walls. Yep.
Tell me what about her spoke to you.
When you're 10, 11 years old and this person is making videos with cartoons in them, I think that was probably the first thing. And it was just fun pop music. She tap danced. I was in tap class at the time and ballet and all the things. So just having her being a tap dancer in music videos, and we didn't have MTV when she came out, but she put out like a VHS tape of her videos. So my parents bought me that. And it was just an easy connection to make at that age of somebody that was so just wholesome, but also fun and entertaining and the perfect age for me to get into some sort of music other than what my parents were. I was never like a New Kids on the Block kid or a Debbie Gibson, even though I appreciated her. It was Paula Abdul for me all the way.
As you were growing up, and how did your music change? Your music fandom change?
I like to think of myself as a really eclectic person.
Okay.
So I like a lot of stuff. When I hit high school was about the time that Nirvana was getting really popular. No, actually I was in middle school because Kurt Cobain died right before my freshman year of high school. But Nirvana was getting really popular. And when I was in high school, Alanis Morissette was a huge deal. And Lilith Fair had just happened. So there was a lot of opportunity for more alternative. I never really liked that was called alternative music, but that's a story for another day. But there was the opportunity for stuff that I could listen to that was beyond what the radio in my town could provide. Mm-hmm. And then I discovered Tori Amos, and that was that.
So talk to me about Tori. What about when I have a Bruce guest on, I'll ask, is there a moment when you first discovered Bruce, and can you articulate why his music spoke to you? Can you share that moment?
Yeah, this is going to be a weird circle moment.
That's so okay. I love weird circles. I told you before we started, I love tangents.
I was in my high school, there was this competition called Forensics, which sounds like we were chopping up dead people, but we weren't. Okay. It was a public speaking and drama competition. And so I was at a forensics tournament. You toured the state and did tournaments around the state on the weekends. And I was at a tournament waiting for the awards ceremony at the end, because you get awards if you win your category. And my friend was listening to a Discman, right? CD Walkman. And I just casually said, what are you listening to? And he said, oh my God, you have to hear this. It's this woman. Her name is Tori Amos. And at the time, VH1 had a show called Crossroads, where I think the theme was that people came on and covered other artists, or other artists sang their songs with a different artist, and they had put out a CD. And Tori Amos had covered I'm on Fire from Bruce Springsteen. And that was the first time I had heard a Tori Amos song was actually a Bruce Springsteen song. So it's a cool circle moment for me to talk to you about this, because that was my first experience, was hearing her play that song. It's haunting. I don't even know if it's still available, if you can find it anywhere, but it's haunting, and it's just her on the piano playing that song. And I took the CD and I took it home and I must have listened to it 50 times over the course of a weekend, just going, oh my God, who is this person? And from there, it was just a matter of finding someone who could help me get my hands on more music, because again, small town. So my parents, I believe, I have to ask my mom for sure, but my parents drove me to the big city, in air quotes, that was about an hour and 15 minutes away, to a real record store. And I bought everything I could get my hands on. So at the time it was Little Earthquakes, Under the Pink, and Boys for Pele were her three albums that were out, and brought those home and just on a loop. And what got me into her, I truly think that one of the issues with pop music, especially when in the 90s, and what was being geared toward girls my age, right, the 14 to 18 year old bunch, that we were being sold that you need to have these love songs and these pop songs that are all about finding the right man and how much you love someone and a broken heart. And what was missing is that's such a small part of being a teenage girl's life. And the Tori Amoses of the world, I think at the same time, like Jewel, and I mentioned Alanis, they dug past that and showed you a perspective that is beyond love, that it came from poetry and it came from writing songs about experiences. And that is a very palatable for a teenage girl, especially if you're trying to figure out, which most girls are, where do you fit? How do you belong? How do you feel empowered? Especially in the mid 90s, when I remember teachers telling me, you're going to take this class so you can learn how to cook for your husband someday. And you're going to.
You're kidding. Even in the middle 90s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had two semesters of a nutrition, I'm using air quotes again, class that was basically a cooking class teaching me how to cook. We had one class where we had to carry around a fake baby for a few days because we had to learn how to care for an infant.
I graduated high school in 77, so I'm older than dirt, right? And I would have loved the fact that they should probably make every person in high school go through a basic cooking class to, we're going to teach you how to not just scramble an egg or make a grilled cheese, but actually be able to do some simple, how to follow a recipe, how to do some simple things, and how to build a basic gravy, as they say in the East Coast, but here in the South, spaghetti sauce. But every time I hear this story, I think of the Bechdel test.
Yeah.
And I remember, I was an adult when I first became aware of this. So it was something, and since then, it is something I can't unsee. Mm-hmm. And for those of you not aware, basically, it says in a film or a book or a TV show that if you have two female characters having a conversation and it's not about a man, because in most cases, anytime two women are on screen, they are talking about a man. And that seems so silly, but once you watch it, you go, yep, not a really a question, just a comment that you're welcome to add to.
No, it's a really good one. When people talk about the Bechdel test, it's connected to this theory called scopophilia, which is connected to a woman named Laura Mulvey, which is that you get pleasure at looking at something, and that women are projected on screen specifically just for pleasure and not necessarily to do anything interesting. And if you, this is a side, but you said you liked rants, this is a side rant, but if you look at a show like The Big Bang Theory and how insanely popular that show was, it got even more popular and more extensive when they added characters for Penny to engage with that were also women. And they talked about stuff that women and girls talk about. And it usually had nothing to do with the men in the room. And that show got huge. It was already big to start with. Like, I'm not underestimating that, but it got massive as soon as Penny had other people to do stuff with and other ways to bring out her personality.
Yeah, because when you add in the other characters, it did. And in some of my favorite episodes is those three having an adventure, right? And how they were all three very different, but at the same bonded. I think that's interesting. It is interesting to do this. So obviously you've done a lot of academic work. I want to go back to when you were a youngster, what did you want to be when you grew up? And was this something that always interested? Did you want to be in academia? Did you want to be a teacher? Did you want to be a researcher? Or how did that journey happen, Adrian?
Yeah, I thought I was going to be an actress, which sounds so trite, but I really did. I thought I was going to
No,
do
nothing
something
wrong
in
with that.
theater. I really thought I would get some sort of degree in theater and then work in a community theater for the rest of my life. Like I was okay with that. I didn't think I was going to move to New York and become insanely popular. I thought that I would get a degree and find a nice community and just do community theater forever. And that didn't last long. Again, that wasn't a great era for especially young women. And it was still quite a time where people like community theater wasn't bringing in a lot of scripts and things and plays that had women dominant roles. But that's what I thought I was going to do. And then when I got to college, I thought, okay, film is very close to theater. And that lasted 2 weeks. And I said, no.
What about it told you that?
You have to have a fire to do a film degree. You have to love, eat, breathe, sleep. Like people are intense and I did not have that intensity. And I honestly had a lot of moments because I still had to take a classes for a semester because I was enrolled and I'm mid into these classes going, this is not what I want to do. I was honestly more annoyed with the attitudes people were presenting toward film. Which probably rings true even to this day and why I study media, because I saw the tropes unraveling with the folks in my classes, which were also dominated by a lot of men. So yeah, it wasn't a fit. And one of the things I emphasize to my students a lot is it's okay if you get into a degree and realize this doesn't work for you. It's fine. It's actually part of the development of figuring out what you like.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure put on kids to figure out at 18 what you're going to do forever. And that's just not realistic. So
yeah,
I'm glad.
One of the things that I wish I could go back and tell young Jesse is I had scored really well on a PSAT or something. I scored really high on the math portion of it. And one of my favorite teachers was a Mrs. Jacobs, who taught me geometry, algebra 2, and advanced math. And I just adored Mrs. Jacobs. And she said, maybe you should study computing science because it's math, but you get to do a little more fun. And when I started class, we were still doing key cards and I was a horrible typist. So I think back that if I could have just been a year or two later, I might have been able to stick it out a little better because you could have seen the math. But I had this unrealistic idea that, similar to Sleeping Beauty, that when I picked the right major, that all the thorns and the problems would fall through and I would just go through and I would enjoy every class and it would be like, oh, I'm on my destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And I made sure to tell this to my son is even if it's doing something you love, it's going to be a lot of work and you have to keep working at it. So I ended up dropping out of college after a couple of years, after going through 3 degrees, I couldn't figure out what I wanted. I loved music. And so I did music for a semester and it was too much work, all these different classes and everything that had nothing to do with singing. I think that's a great counsel you're giving to your students about that. Yeah. So based on this, when did you first become interested in what was that road to Damascus moment? If there was one where you said, there's some stuff going on in gender and I want to learn more about it.
Yeah, that's been a lifelong thing.
Okay, it always has been.
Yeah, my parents were both social workers. So
okay.
I was raised with a lot of awareness about how unequal people can be. And they made it a point every summer when they had 2 weeks off, we would go somewhere outside of our town. And my mom doesn't fly. So we would drive all over the country. I mean, they drove me as far as Arizona, California border, they drove me all the from Michigan. We went to Washington, D.C. a lot to see the Veterans Memorial stuff there for my dad. They, I've seen every national monument, every roadside, something historic happened here. Like they made it a point to do that for me. Wow. So I remember being really little and being aware that people are unequal and that this is just, and I didn't have that obviously vocabulary for it at the time,
right.
But, and I was also a voracious reader. My mom, I tell this story a lot, but my mom and my dad were social workers. So they're, you're not rich when you're a social worker.
Sure.
I'm sure most people are aware of that. And having a kid who would read a book a day was becoming a financial situation for my parents. And so my mom made a deal with the librarian in our town and said, listen, I know that the limit for books is 12 for 2 weeks. Can you give my kid 14 because she reads a book a day? And they did. They said, sure. And they put a little note on my little library card that said she's allowed to have two extra a week or a time. And I remember reading everything from Nancy Drew mysteries to there was a book on Cleopatra that I read that still impacts me to this day. And I'm sure if I found it now, it would be like 50 pages and full of pictures, but anything I could get my hands on, I read. And between having parents that wanted to make sure that I understood that the world, I remember being 10 and my mom saying, you need to understand that the world is bigger than this town. And I remember her saying, I need you to experience other things. I need you to live in other places. You need to go in other areas. Having that was great support and also really good for a kid that was just curious about everything and wanted to understand things.
So as you started working on this, talk to me about your first study. And well, let's get back to a basic. Why, what was you decided your love of music and Tori, by the way, I Googled and Tori Amos, I'm on Fire is available on YouTube.
Oh, so, good. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So I
okay.
just Googled it and I will listen to that. I'm looking to it. And I love the fact that she does start with Hey Little Girl, which at times can be a little, you know, like, I don't know if Bruce would still write it with those lyrics.
It's different when a woman sings it, though. Like,
yes, it
comes across, when you hear it, you'll hear the
the
spins she's putting on it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for the same, on the opposite way, I feel like Dave Mason's version, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, is a very different song than When Carole King or the Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. It is, they're both great versions, and that is a great song. But hearing a guy sing it from that is just, it gives it a little different spin of, anyway. So what in the back of your mind, you've got this diverse, you have this love of reading, but you really have loved different kind of music, especially female artists. So when did you connect the dots, or was it that simple?
I don't know if it was that simple. The thing, my bachelor's degree is in a program called liberal studies, which people think is the study of liberal people, and it's not. It just means I structured my own degree, and I came up with this interpersonal communications degree. And while I was doing that, I met a woman that would have, it still is to this day, but would become my mentor, who ran the Women's Center at the college I was at. And she hired me to be a volunteer coordinator after I graduated. And I did that job for 3 years. And part of the work that I did was I was trained in being a crisis counselor. I don't want to say counselor because I wasn't a therapist, but I was like an interventionist, maybe is a better term, like a crisis interventionist. So when students would come into the Women's Center in crisis, I would be like their first stop and I would help get them to wherever they needed to be to help them.
Okay.
And most of those crises were sexual assault and sexual harassment stuff. So I learned very quickly how trauma was affecting people and did a lot of work on my college campus around that.
Okay.
So when I went to grad school, I knew I wanted to study media and gender in some form, but it wasn't until I started working on my doctoral program that, and I don't even know how I got there. I don't even remember what got me to this point because it's been almost 20 years, but I remember thinking if I could study Tori Amos and her fans, that would be.
Hang on just a minute.
Oh, sure.
Go ahead.
Hold on, let me drink this.
Yeah, please.
I remember thinking if I could study Tori Amos and her fans, that would be a fun thing. And then I took a class where the professor said, why can't you? And I thought, why can't I? That makes
Yeah.
perfect sense. I'm a
I could,
sociologist.
couldn't I?
Yeah, I'm a sociologist. I study gender. These things could all mash together. And I had no clue that study of music in terms of its social impact was even a thing until I got into it. It's basically based out of an idea of sociology of emotions, where we build emotional connections to things. In your case, it would be fandom related to Bruce Springsteen and what his music does for people and how it makes them feel. And
Yeah.
it's the same across the board. But when you start to introduce things like gender or race or sexual orientation, you get a whole other mess of variables that can help explain why people are so into something. And then as I started doing it, I interviewed 42 women who were fans of Tori Amos. I can't even tell you how many hours that came out to be. It was a lot of hours. And I just was very interested in how people who had experienced trauma used music to help themselves heal. I still am. I'm still very drawn to any sort of media that takes someone who has been through something traumatic and shows what happened to them on the other side of it. And I usually am more attracted to stuff that's, what do you do 5 years after this thing has happened? How do people cope in the long term? As opposed to, I think we tend to focus a lot on the immediate after effect of how someone is, but trauma follows you throughout your life course, and it pops up in places where you don't expect it to. And I've always been interested in how people deal with it when it has those kind of moments of reoccurrence that you weren't expecting, or maybe you thought you were over something. And how does something like music help someone get through that? Like after the therapy is done, and yet 5 years later, this thing happens that makes you revisit your trauma. What do you do in terms of culture to get you through that?
Yes, this is. I want to get some more details, but I do. You had mentioned you were kind enough to say you've checked a couple episodes out, and that's very kind of you. One of them I'm really proud of is back in August of last year, Sarah Gregory joined me, and I will send you the link to the episode. But in overly broad terms, her grandmother was murdered by a friend of the family.
Oh my God.
Incredibly traumatic, devastated her, sent her down a downward path that took her a lot of time, a lot of self-medication, abuse. She got her life straight. She became clean, sober. But the one obstacle left, as she talked to her sober coach and her sponsor, is I will never forgive this man. Don't even ask me. And spoil ahead, she's driving, listening to Eastern Radio, as one who's a Springsteen fan does. And Bruce's new song, Letter to You, came out. And this is in the 20s. It came out. And it struck her. She went home and she wrote a letter to that man and mailed it. And I will let you listen to the episode, but the ending is she is there when he's executed with forgiveness and love in her heart. Yeah, very powerful story. Very
That's
powerful story.
amazing. That's
And
amazing.
I say this, I mentioned earlier that I'd lost my brother last year, and it was around the holiday season. And someone who I'm close to, I won't name who, but said, we had a pretty good year this year. We didn't lose anyone major. And I
Oh
said, eh,
no.
except my brother.
Yeah.
Oh shit, I'm sorry. And I'm like, and I remember this. I was reading a book about, there was an interview about a guy who did a biography of Michael Jordan. And they said that when his father was murdered, there was a lot of discussion that could it have been his gambling and all this, and ends up being just a random act. And that he then quit basketball and went and played baseball. And talked about he thought about his dad. And the writer said, I think it's Bob Green, to the world, this is old news because we move so quickly in our news cycles. But to Michael, this is still recent, right? And I think that when you mention, okay, well, it's been a year, what's up? Haven't you moved past this? And that's just not the way things work sometimes, is it?
No, there's a really good analogy. I'll send you the link for this because I'm going to mess it up, but there's a really good analogy of a ball in a box. Have you heard about this in the grief button? So grief is, if you think about grief as a box with a button in it, and there's a ball that's floating around. When something awful first happens, the ball is huge and it keeps hitting the button over and over again because it can't escape the box. And then as time goes on, the ball gets smaller. So it's not as likely to hit the panic button or the grief button. But when it does, you're surprised because you think, oh, my ball is really small in this box. What is the chance? What are the chances that this is happening? And that's what grief is, and that's what trauma is, that at the onset, it's huge and it's taking up everything in you to just exist. And then as time passes, hopefully things start to feel a little bit less intense, but it's still there and it's still going to hit that button and then you're still going to feel it. It's just the reality of how people are, as how people think about things. And it doesn't surprise me at all that big events or things that are seemingly insignificant sometimes trigger people because that ball in that box is always going to be there.
So let's talk about the latest book.
Okay.
An hour into the episode. Are you still good on time? Okay. So talk to me. Tell me a little about it.
About my Tori book or my Taylor Swift book? That's my Taylor Swift.
Let's do Tori and then Taylor. We'll do both
Okay.
T's.
So Tori came out in 2013.
Okay. So it's not a new book. Yes.
No, but it is forever my baby. So I will
Okay.
talk about it until I am blue
Okay.
in the face because it was my dissertation and it was probably one of the things I'll be the most proud of. The people that participated in it, I'm always eternally grateful for the people who let me interview them and share their stories. That book came out and it was a focus on, it was the first fan study that came out on Tori Amos, obviously, but also on a woman in pop music. That mine was the first one. So there's not a lot of studies of fandom out there. There is a book on Bruce Springsteen that came out in 97 called Tramps Like Us that was a fandom study. And I'm forgetting the author's name, Frank something. And I used that book a lot when I was writing my dissertation because his was the first real fan studies that had been out there. And at conferences I've met, there's a ton of Bruce Springsteen scholars out there. I know you've had a few, but there's a lot. But anyway, my book was one of the first, and it's ignited in me a passion for understanding fandom, for understanding why people get so enthralled in things and wanting to become so connected to a performer. And Taylor Swift is actually a really easy leap for me a decade later because her fans are not that different than Tori Amos fans. They're a little younger. There's kids, and you don't see a lot of children at a Tori Amos show. It's not really, I don't know that it would be appropriate, especially in the 90s when she really got big. Taylor Swift is very close in terms of songwriting, poetic songwriting. People really peg her as someone who just writes songs about relationships, but that's not what's happening. If you listen, especially to like her last three or four albums, it's very much songs about life and experience, and relationship is one of those experiences, but it's not all of it.
Sure.
So it's an easy connection for me to draw between the two.
And there is an easy, almost lazy, like one of the memes running around was Kelce talking to Andy Reid and said, "Look, if we lose this game, Taylor Swift's going to break up with me and write a song about me." And that's just That is saying that Brian Wilson wrote songs about surfing and cars. And yes, he did. He did a little bit more.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly.
And so that's, but it's easy to put in that. I also think there is a snobbery among some fans that if it's popular, it's got to be crap. Paula Abdul, just fun little pop. Not going. Cyndi Lauper. I just had some people on that are part of a campaign to get Cyndi Lauper in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
She's
And
not. I didn't know she wasn't.
that is the exact thing they say is the biggest thing hurting them is that everyone is shocked that she is not in it.
That is a tragedy.
It is. It really is. I say young men, yeah, two great guys. The podcast will be out in a couple of weeks, but they were just great. They're both of lifelong fans of hers. But anyway, and I know there is a hole in my listening is I've not explored a lot of time with Taylor Swift. I just haven't taken the time to do it. I did have a wonderful person a couple of years ago that does Taylor A to Z. And she and her husband are doing every Taylor Swift song in alphabetical order. She's also a huge Springsteen fan. So she joined me and we talked about both the connections. Bruce has been on record about he thinks she's amazing. And she tells the story about meeting him backstage when he brought his daughters to his daughter and her friends and him signing her guitar and doing Dancing in the Dark for her. But yeah, I could see the connection between these two artists.
She also has been praised by Billy Joel, which I thought was awesome. He said something like, she's the next him. Like he sees a lot of herself in her. Yeah, it's funny to me. Artist has the person that you can make a historical connection to, right? Tori Amos, people compare her a lot to Carole King or, I don't know, Joni Mitchell. You get that one a lot too. And Taylor Swift is going to be, her songwriting skills are on par with the Tori Amoses of the world. I don't know that we have a musician right now, and I don't know all the musicians, so I'm sure this is going to be problematic, but I think that when you have someone who takes the care into creating lyrics that she takes, because I know in a minute you're going to ask me about Mary getting in the car, right? Yeah. In Tori Amos fandom, we have Marianne and we have Neil Gaiman, and those two characters make reoccurring themes in all of her songs. And since I've been working on this book on Taylor Swift, I'm starting to realize that her reoccurring theme is this love triangle between these three kids who are about 18 years old, and it threads its way through a lot of her songs in different albums. And that to me is so interesting and is such the mark of a good songwriter, where you're not making a one and done, which you can make one and done songs, it's fine. But when you're really putting that care in, that shows me that you're very invested in what you want people to hear. And you're also very invested in your craft, and that this is not just a song to you. It's some sort of, Tori called them sonic novels when she did an album called Scarlet's Walk, which is one of my personal favorites of all time. And she called it a sonic novel because it was this character of Scarlet taking a journey across the United States and everything she saw in post 9/11, came out in 2002. And that to me is the mark of an interesting songwriter. And Bruce Springsteen obviously does it as well. That's why I think this thread between what you're interested in, what I'm interested in, works out so well, because he's got that too, where it's thoughtful songwriting and intentional.
Yeah. And I'm a huge Neil Gaiman fan. I just adore his books. And so I always think that's an interesting relationship between them. That seems like a very mutually respectful about each other's creativity. I have not checked out Scarlet's Walk. I just pulled it up, so I will check that out. That sounds very interesting. I will add that to my to listen.
It's very much a 9/11 reaction album, because I think it came out in 2002 or 2003, and a very much a reaction to the Bush presidency of that time. It's interesting how she made this road trip theme, connected it to politics and to the emotions people were feeling and this new world that we were experiencing at that point.
Yeah. The Rising was Bruce's album after the 9/11, which he is very quick to, he was working on a lot of them before 9/11, but certainly was significant. Yeah. So when is the Taylor Swift book going to be available?
Fingers crossed. I'll let you know for sure, but fingers crossed, it'll be a year from now. So March, hopefully March of 25.
You got to come back to help promote it.
Okay. Yeah, I'd love
to. So Adrian, what have I not asked you I should have?
I don't think anything. This is all you. Whatever you want to ask, I'll answer.
All right. Very nice. The reason I asked that question years ago, I had a guy on the podcast and we had a lovely talk. And at the end, I stopped recording and he said, next time I'm on, I'll tell you about me getting drunk with the E Street Band. How the hell do you not lead with that story on a Bruce Springsteen podcast?
I will tell you, I met her in 2009. Okay. And I have just the best husband on the planet. He did a mini tour with me because I was writing my dissertation and I was trying to collect data. So we saw her we were living in Michigan. So we saw her in Chicago, Milwaukee, and then Indianapolis. And when in Chicago, she does meet and greets before every show. And in Chicago, I went, there's no way I'm standing outside in Chicago. There's going to be 1,000 people there. Milwaukee was very few people. And so my husband stood in line with me for a couple hours. And this man made friends with absolutely everyone in line. He was like, who can I go get drinks for? He was just perfectly happy to just be there and hang out and meet people. He pulled out a bag of Cheetos at one point and was just like, who's hungry? And when he got bored, he would go walk around the river and come back. And then I got to meet her, and it was one of those moments where you move out of your body. I know I said things. I handed her a letter, and that night she played a song that I requested in my letter and knew where I was sitting because the dork, I put what row I was in, and I was in the fourth row, so it was easy to see me, and sang it to me. And that was, to me, I'm done. I'm good for the, I don't, some people feel the need to go back and keep meeting her. And that's great if that's what you need to do. But I've always felt like that was my moment and it was fine. That's all I needed in terms of her acknowledging that I'm on this planet. She knew about my dissertation. She knew about my book because her manager had to sign off on some stuff for all of it. So I sent him the book and a nice note saying, thank you so much for everything. And then through that, I became friends, I'm using air quotes, with the man who does her string arrangements on Facebook. And sometimes I message him from time to time. But that's as close as I ever need to be again. Of if the opportunity presented itself, of course, I would do it. But I don't feel the need to keep coming back and seeing her over and over again.
I love that. So Bruce was doing a book signing, because he had done his autobiography. And when you call it a signing, it really isn't a signing. You stood in line, you got your picture taken with him, and then they handed you a copy of a signed book, which was still awesome. And so I've told the story multiple times, but I'm driving down from Dallas to go to this Austin signing. What am I going to say? What am I going to say? And I practice over and over again. And then when I get it, I'm ready with my pitch. Last year, I spent 9 months unemployed, and every day I listened to Better Days and Land of Hope and Dreams to keep me hope. And I just need to tell you thank you for that. And I think by the time I got to 9 months, next! So I don't know if he heard it, but I've said many times I needed to say it more than I needed him to hear it.
Yep.
So I did get my picture taken with him. He is my ultimate... I would love to have him as a guest, obviously. That would be amazing. And it's okay because his music's been the companion to me that what we need.
Yep.
That's awesome. I didn't think to ask this. Obviously, you've seen her a few times. How many times have you seen her perform, Tori?
I feel like it's 20.
Okay.
Is
there anything you haven't heard her play live that you would want to?
No, I have a spreadsheet of everything I've ever heard her play live. And the last time I saw her was in Seattle last summer. I actually took my friend who I went to high school with and who had listened to her in my car with me for a long time. So he was excited to experience this live. And he was making fun of me quite a bit because I was adding to my spreadsheet on my phone as she was playing. But as one does when you want to make sure you get it right. No, the things I love, the songs I love, my favorite songs I've heard multiple times live, and I'm always happy with whatever I get. Some people really go in with a agenda. Sometimes I have a list of things I'd like to hear, and it's great if you do, but I've seen her a lot, so I'm good. I'm really good. Mm-hmm.
That's awesome. That's great. There is a website that friend of the podcast Echo does called My Boss Time.
Oh,
and he does all that. He has every concert Bruce has ever done all the way back to the 70s, and you select which shows you've attended. And then he does it behind the scenes. He will show here is every song you've heard. Here's the songs you've heard the most often. Here are his rarity songs. He's only covered, he did Van Halen's Jump once. He's done it twice, and I was there once. Oh. So that's a rarity. Yes. My friend who's a huge Dylan fan said, I wish someone would do that for Bob Dylan.
Yeah,
he's seen Bob a lot of times. So that's awesome. I admire your, do you know right offhand, what song have you heard the most from her?
Cornflake Girl. But I think that's because that was her closing song for many years. Okay. And Precious Things. Those are her two closing songs for a long time. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank you so much. I'm going to ask you the Mary question, and then I'll let everyone know how I want you to share everyone how they can find you. But I end every podcast with the Mary question. And what that is Jay Armstrong, who is an honors English teacher, would give the lyrics to Thunder Road to his students. They would read it as if it was a poem. Then they would discuss the different themes Bruce explores in the film, in the poem, the song, and then would ask his class the question, does Mary get in the car? So that is your question. Does Mary get in the car?
This is so hard because I understand how fandom works and that there is probably, no matter what I say, there's going to be opinions and I am not educated enough to
so
say for
I will
sure.
Tell you right now.
Okay.
50-50.
Really?
Half of fandom says, yes, she gets in the car. The other half of my guests say, no, she doesn't.
So here's
and
the thing.
There's probably about 48-48 because there's probably about 2-4% that say it doesn't matter. We can never know. And they give an other. So yeah. So you're covered.
Okay, good. Because I was going to be in the, I don't know that it matters camp.
Okay.
When I was reading this and listening to this, so is there another song that she appears in about the river? Is that the idea that's the same person?
So that's a debate.
Okay.
In real world, the river is based on his older sister or his younger sister.
Oh.
His sister got pregnant right out of high school. She married the guy. They are still married. Mm-hmm. They have had a wonderful life together. They still go to the rodeo because
wow.
He was a cowboy and he talks about that. There is many people believe that the song Racing in the Street, there is a line where my baby sits on the porch of her daddy's house and they go, is that the same porch she danced across on the things? So he uses Mary a lot and it not necessarily, is it the same Mary or not? Is it because of the biblical work?
Yeah.
There is a song called Moonlight Motel off Western Stars, which is an album that came out like in 1819. And Moonlight Motel is all about a husband grieving the death of his wife. And they're at this seedy hotel in California and he talks about it. And so I had one guest say that absolutely they get in the car, they drive all to California, and then Moonlight Motel is him mourning the death of Mary. Fandom, in this case, I think that there is a lot more of... there's a lot of grace that people just, you know, like whether the dress sways or waves has people more anger, but whether she gets in the car, it's very good. So good.
I think she, as I was reading it and listening to it, I think she's an idea more than a person. But what I appreciated about it is that, so this song came out in the 70s, am I right?
Yes.
So what I appreciated about it was he was giving her a choice. And it was come with me or a choice of you don't have to stay in this town. You can do this with me. And I think that was ahead of its time to be offering the woman in the song the choice of stay, go. But I saw it as an idea rather than a person. So I don't know. I don't think so. But what was interesting to me were the last few lines where he talked about the ghosts of the and the eyes of the boys you sent away and the graduation gown in being in rags. That to me told me that Mary was dealing with some trauma and he was trying to take her away from it. And I can appreciate him saying something like that in a song at that point when 70s rock wasn't known to be exceptionally kind to women. So this, I thought that was really important and impactful that he did that.
Very nice. I love that answer. Adrienne, if someone wants to reach you, what's the best way?
So I am on Instagram at Dr, but not at Dr, period, Adrienne, okay. TB. And then my website is adriennetrier-bienick.com.
Okay. This is great. I just love spending time with you this morning. I hope you had fun. Yeah, I want you to come back anytime you want, definitely to promote the book. I think we're going to end with Lily is dancing on the table. We've all been too far today. Even a glamorous bitch can be in need. This is where the honey from the killer bees. I'm glad you're on my side. Sure. I'm glad you're on my side.
A little taxi ride. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you, Adrienne. Thank you,
thank
listeners.
Thank you for having me.
Remember to be safe, be kind, and we'll talk to you soon. Goodbye.
There we go. Another episode. I'm about to go through a couple of things where you can reach me and give me feedback. So if you want to skip this, I understand. But I do hope you check it out every once in a while. I'm available on Twitter at JesseJacksonDFW. The show is available at SetLustingBruce. You can send me an email, SetLustingBruce@gmail.com. You can send me a voicemail at 469-249-2442. I am currently doing a few other podcasts. Perfectly Good Podcast, John Hiatt from A to Z, where Sylvan Groth and I discuss every John Hiatt song in alphabetical order. My Babylon 5 podcast is Last Best Hope for Conversation, where Lou, Karen, and I discuss every episode of Babylon 5 in chronological order. I still am doing Next Stop Everywhere, the Doctor Who podcast with my brother in time, Charles Skaggs. And then finally, How Many Podcasts, the only podcast on the internet that counts, where my buddies and I discuss pop culture. You can go to our Patreon page and support the podcast for as little as a dollar a month. You can go to our Facebook page, like, and please, please go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast and leave a 5-star rating and review for all of the podcasts that I'm doing. It's okay if you don't listen to them, but if you subscribe and rate, it really will make my day better. Thank you, and I will talk to you soon.
You just heard the fun talking, hard rocking, music loving, album ranking, fan thinking, joy spreading, lyric reading, story sharing podcast that is the one, the only, Set Listing Bruce. The theme for Set Listing Bruce was written by David Rosen, used by permission.